You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is Walk the Talk with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. In these podcasts, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who have struggled to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a serving police officer for over 20 years. You're very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. Peter Kirkham was born and bred on a farm in Cheshire. He travelled to London and basically never went back. He joined the Metropolitan Police as a special constable whilst at university and joined as a regular constable immediately after he finished his degree. He served in the Met for over 21 years, in both uniform and CID, at all ranks up to Detective Chief Inspector. He spent 5 years on the Flying Squad, dealing with armed robbers in the early 90s, followed by 2 years as a uniformed duty officer at Brixham. He was a senior investigating officer for 5 years before leaving in 2002. He has since worked as a security management and policing services consultant, doing a variety of roles. He has trained police officers on various courses and still works as a corporate fraud investigator. Since 2010, he has become an increasingly outspoken critic of the cuts to policing, often appearing in the media to highlight the damage done, in his opinion, by the then Home Secretary and later Prime Minister Theresa May. So join us now as we find out about the man, what makes him tick, and his views on policing that have drawn both praise and criticism. Peter, welcome to Walk the Talk. You're well known both on social media and mainstream media for being a fierce defender of policing in this country. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your own policing career and how you found yourself in your current role as a policing commentator.
I was born and bred in Cheshire, on a farm in Cheshire. Came down to London to university. As soon as I was 18 and a half, I can remember doing it. I walked into Chelsea Police Station and became a special. Don't ask me why. Because I was still an actual student at that time. Uh-huh. And it wasn't long after the student disorders in the mid-70s. There was lots of questions at Scotland Yard who thought I was some sort of infiltrator, but eventually got in. After 6 months of being a special, which was very different then to being a special now, you were on foot all the time and you stood on broken windows and whatever. But I made myself busy, and within 6 months I decided that's what I wanted to do. So joined the police straight after my degree finished, joined the Met in 1981, then worked as a PC at Hammersmith, then on the District Crime Squad, which came in when I was there, then was a DC at Fulham. Went on promotion as a sergeant at Chiswick and Brentford, then as a detective sergeant to King's Cross and Islington, then from there on to the Flying Squad as detective sergeant, acting detective inspector. Much to everybody's surprise, mostly mine, I got on the accelerated promotion course, special course at that point, with sort of 9-10 years as a sergeant, no more probably. And found myself at Bram's Hill with all these newly promoted brand new sergeants. The next in service after me had 7 years service total, was a newly promoted sergeant. After that, we were talking about 1 or 2 years. Now, I don't know if I scared them, but they sure as hell scared me with not knowing what they didn't know. It actually accelerated me out of the job, really, being exposed to so many chiefs for the first time. I was totally and utterly unimpressed and underwhelmed by what I saw. I decided probably at that point that I didn't particularly want to be a senior officer. I hadn't joined to do that, I joined to be a cop. But anyway, went back to the Met, went as a uniform inspector to Brixton, Bearing in mind that I'd just done 5 years on the flying squad, they thought I must be some sort of spy sent to keep an eye on them. I think some of them probably still do. Then I did a very short time in a policy unit and as a staff officer for about 9 months in total, year in total. Went to Bramshill again for the second part of the course, came back as a DCI and did my last 5 years as a DCI running a murder squad, leaving in 2002. How did I become a policing commentator? I'd met a guy called Jeff Edwards, who was the chief crime reporter of the Daily Mirror, who had been introduced to me independently by two or three senior detectives that I knew and respected as being a trustworthy member of the media. I'd got to know him socially. We'd meet from time to time for a beer and a curry. And he said to me, why don't you do some media stuff? Because you seem able to sort of talk about quite complex and technical legal and policing issues in common sense, general language. So he put me in touch with a few people and then it just built from there, really. Initially, it was literally explaining policing as opposed to having any political bent to it whatsoever. Mm. But then when Theresa May appeared over the hill, I came to the conclusion that somebody needed to speak up loudly for the front line. The police senior officers as well as frontline officers, they're restricted in what they can say for various reasons. The Federation likewise, the Federation under its previous leadership wasn't exactly stunning. And so I started to get involved in that, and then as she carried on with the devastation she caused, I just got into that more and more and more. A couple of my interviews on Sky went viral.
And we'll talk about that in a short while, actually, that interview. It's quite a famous interview that you did.
Yeah, and that went viral, and I was absolutely astounded by the feedback that I got from across the country. Literally, officers of every rank, including a chief constable, contacted me one way or the other to say, you know, well said, it's got to be said, you know, these things are really important. And so I sort of made a bit of a rod for my own back, really. Until things have changed, I don't feel able to walk away from it. So here I am.
I just want to go back because you mentioned you're clearly a very clever man. And whilst you're at university, you walked into the police station. What was it that made you decide that you wanted to join the police?
Absolutely no idea whatsoever. Couldn't tell you why. No history of policing in my family. Well, one of those people that you call a cousin but isn't quite a cousin, is a sort of cousin type level relative. Yeah. He was a PC in Cheshire at the time I was growing up. He ended up as an inspector. So I'd see him from time to time. He was on motorway patrols for a while and the M6 wasn't far from the farm. Yeah. So occasionally they'd come off the motorway for a cup of tea or whatever. Or if they were coming in and out of Northwich, they'd pop in on the way back. So they were around and, you know, you sit in a police car and have a go at the steering wheel and the wah-wahs. I really don't know why I walked in through Chelsea police station doors.
What would you say was your favourite time that you spent in your policing career?
Flying squad, definitely. If I could have stayed... Well, the posting on the flying squad is usually 3 years. You can sometimes push it to five if you're lucky. I managed to push it to five last couple as an acting DI. In those days, we were trusted to get on with stuff. We were armed ourselves. We ran our own armed surveillance intervention operations. So as an acting DI, I would be in charge of a surveillance team, two or three gunships, making the decision on jumping on them when they're coming across the pavement. So yeah, if I could have stayed there, I'd still be there now. By far the best. But I've enjoyed all of it. I mean, the fact that I move back and to between CID and uniform every time, I think that illustrates, it's quite unusual, and I think it illustrates that I do. Those that worked with me as an inspector or sergeant in uniform will tell you that I was more than happy to be out and about nicking people.
I read somewhere, I don't know if this is true, described you as a memorable, if slightly irritating person, but I'd trust him.
Yeah, it's not the first time I've heard stuff like that. My inspector when I was a uniform sergeant described me as a bit of an enigma, and he put it in my annual report one year, and it said something like, I don't really understand Sergeant Kirkham. On the one hand, he's far too familiar with the officers and constables, as he referred to them, with the constables on the team, and he socialises with them and goes for a drink with them and goes for a curry with them and all the rest of it. However, on the other hand, he's he sets himself and them high standards and enforces those to the point that's, you know, abrupt, rude, or a bit over the top sometimes. And he just couldn't get his head around the fact there's on duty and there's off duty. As a sergeant, as a supervisor of any sort, you're not there to be liked, you're there to do a job. It's nice to be liked as well, yes, but your job is what you're being paid for, and that's what you need to do. And as Dennis O'Connor, our assistant commissioner, before he became HMIC, said, nice is not enough.
How would you describe to people who know nothing about the police service what happened to it since 2010? And perhaps we could start with the publication of the Windsor Report.
The Windsor Report was sort of the lead up to it, but I'd take it back even before that. The government, and the Tories especially, have had this thing about the police being the last unreformed public service, and they've gone on and on about it for decades. Back in the 90s, we had the Sheehy Inquiry, which was led by Patrick Sheehy, who'd come from British American Tobacco, to look into the pay and conditions of the police service and the organisation of the police service. David Cameron, we now realise, was a sidekick working on that. That report came in and it made all sorts of recommendations about cutting pay and allowances, about removing some of the ranks, and a variety of things, some of which happened, some of which sort of came in a bit and then went away again. But broadly speaking, it was resisted by the police service. It wasn't put together with a view to efficient policing. It was put together with a view to penny pinching. And it didn't take. And David Cameron has obviously carried that for, you know, the time since then. Mm. It's 20 years in the gestation. Before taken over into 2010, he did a speech, I think it was in about 2006 or 2007, that set out his agenda for taking on the police again. And it was bringing forward some of the stuff that had not taken after Sheehy, having another go at it. So we had Windsor appointed to do the same again, effectively. And he went at it with a vengeance, really. There were two reports, both of them were damaging to police pay conditions, effectiveness and whatever. He was rewarded with a knighthood, and he was rewarded with a post as the first non-ex-chief constable in recent memory, as head of the Inspector of Constabulary, Her Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constabulary. And he's still there, and he's still writing reports that basically slag the police off. Now, his tone has changed a little bit, not so much in the nature of the reports, but in the things he says outside those reports. And I think that he has realised that what he and the Tory government, and primarily Theresa May, have done has gone way, way, way too far. He still criticises the police. And if you look at his reports, and there's enough of them now, he goes around in a circle, especially with these Peel reports that look at every aspect of a force. Mm. And so there's two or maybe three Peel reports, four Peel reports, done on the same basis for forces now. And he'll criticise a force for, say, neighbourhood policing. Oh, it's really bad at neighbourhood policing, everything else is okay. 1 year. So the chief gets that and goes, oh my God, we've got to put some resources into neighbourhood policing. So he shuffles around, pushes some stuff into neighbourhood policing, but he hasn't got anyone spare, so he has to take them from somewhere else. So lo and behold, next time they come round, they go, oh, neighbourhood policing is much better now, but CID's failing, or safeguarding's failing, or response is failing, or whatever. And so they then move everything round to that. And we go round this loop. And after about 4 years, you're back to where you started with neighbourhood policing failing again. And it's just nonsense. What he needs to say is they simply do not have enough people to do the work that is required of them. We need honesty from politicians. We need honesty from the likes of Windsor. I'm afraid we haven't got it.
Are you arguing that the police service didn't need reform?
There's a difference between reform and cuts. I would say that it needed reform. We are all that served through the 1990s into 2000s, we know that there were pockets of the organisation that were not working as well as they should. We knew that there were pockets of the organisation that weren't as busy as other people. We knew there were things that could and should be done differently. All of that is great, but all they did was cut. They took the view, the idiotic view, and Theresa May led this personally. They took the view, crime is going down, police deal with crime, therefore we need less police. That is idiotic on numerous levels. So they said, oh, crime's going down. Let's cut the police. They failed to involve the police in that process. They just cut. And I don't know if you remember, but when the cuts were first mooted, the first round of cuts were mooted, the police ACPO had a look at the fact that the public service was going to have to take a cut, and they said, oh, right, we can probably do 6 to 8%, I think it was, and you know, we're content that that won't have a significant impact on service delivery. And, you know, every large organisation can do with a dose of a bit of a cut for a while to make it think about how it's spending its money. So, you know, that would have been fine. But they said, oh no, you're getting 10. And then they gave them 12. And then over the sequential years, that went up to 15, to 18, to 20. It peaked at 25. 25% cut in budget for some forces, most forces. The Met, for instance, has a budget of 4 billion. It's now got a budget of 3 billion. That's a 25% cut in budget at a time when crime is now through the roof. The population is up. The problems are up. Everything is up except the numbers. So you've got fewer cops doing more stuff to a higher standard. That can't work. What they should have done was they should have taken the opportunity of saying, get yourself sorted out. How do you need to reform? Here's an 8 to 10% cut. Show us that you've reformed and improved efficiency.
So regarding your own media profile, you're probably best known for your account on Twitter, where it's fair to say that you don't suffer fools gladly, and you've come under some criticism of the language that you've used in some of the disagreements you've had. Interestingly, it is a style totally different to your mainstream profile. How did that come about, and do you now regret the style you adopted?
It's me, basically. Anyone that's ever worked with me will recognise that and say, that's him. And, you know, people say, don't say things online that you wouldn't say to someone's face. Mm. Anyone that knows me will tell you I'll say that and worse to your face. Mm. And I'll justify it. I mean, there's my, it's almost a catchphrase now, fuckwit, which I chose quite deliberately because it was less offensive and less sweary than anything else. I view that as a semi-swear word, if you like. You know, I had on my profile for a while that I was fuckwit intolerant, which sort of summed it up beautifully. Yeah. I've got a free strikes and you're out thing. There's so many utter idiots on Twitter, trolls, you know, whatever. You get free goes. If you say or do something or ask something on Twitter, I respond to you, and you come back with more stupidity, well, that goes through three iterations and then you're blocked. Life's too short.
Well, at least you're giving people three chances. There's a worrying trend I've noticed at the moment on Twitter is that if you don't agree with me, I'll unfollow you or you can unfollow me. It's getting very intolerant.
Yeah, the amounts of intolerance on Twitter are extraordinary. Twitter, I think, is particularly bad for it. Facebook tends to be a bit more like harassments, long-running feuds and family feuds and whatever. I can't say I have a lot to do with Facebook. But Twitter is, you know, the tolerance is definitely going. We got this bubble sort of thing. People live in their bubbles politically. People live in their bubbles all around. I'm very aware that I live in a policing bubble, if you like. You know, most of my followers and most of the people I follow and most of the stuff I talk about on Twitter is policing related. I don't understand why people talk about their personal lives and, you know, Instagram and taking a picture of your dinner and all that. What's all that about?
I'm just wondering whether Twitter has become a caricature and an extension of, really, about, I suppose, how society is becoming today, where people are getting less intolerant of other people's views. It almost seems now that if you disagree with somebody that you can't be friends with them anymore.
Undoubtedly, it reflects society to a certain extent, but I think more than that, it drives society, and people see that stuff happening on Twitter and Facebook, and they then roll that into their real life. The internet, I've said right from the beginning, that the internet is potentially a huge force for good in the world, but equally it's a huge force for evil, and it's not really being properly, it's not been properly regulated from the start. But I do like to try and follow a few people that have got opposing views. I've got a selection on there, but unfortunately some of them tend to be a bit too much anti-police for me. I don't mind criticism, I don't mind challenge. I certainly don't mind challenge and asking questions about policing.
Well, going back to mainstream media, and we did touch upon it earlier. In 2017, you were interviewed on Sky News, and who said that the government of the day were lying about police numbers. The piece went viral, with many officers supporting your stance. Did you have any idea before the interview started how it was going to play out that day?
None whatsoever. It was just another routine Sky News phone call. Can you come and do us an interview? It was the day after the London Bridge attacks. They were doing it from the next bridge down, Southwark Bridge, I think. So we were, you know, meant to go there to see them. It was a Sunday. I was meant to be travelling up to Lincolnshire to deliver a fraud training course that afternoon. So I didn't really want to be dragged into town for a couple of hours and then get away later. But I was persuaded to go. I got there. I found that they'd got about a million commentators there. They got every commentator they could think of, and they were all queuing up. I was meant to be on at 2 o'clock, just after 2 o'clock, and then someone else took that slot because they had to go, and then someone else had booked into the other slots, and I said, well, I can hang around for a bit. So as it happened, I went on at just after 3, and the presenter changed it at 3 o'clock, and Kay Burley took over. And so I was chatting to Kay a little bit beforehand, which is something that you don't usually have the opportunity for. You walk in, do the interview, walk out again, because they're already doing stuff when you arrive. So I had a chance for a bit of a chat, and she said, oh, well, you know, we covered this, and she was standing there listening to them with me. Yeah. So what should we talk about? And she brought up the fact that the government had said that we'd got more armed officers than ever, and it was Michael Fallon that had said it a few days earlier. Now, I don't know whether that was a deliberate lie on his part or whether he was talking about specialist counter-terrorism, specialist firearms officers, of which there were more, by about 6 or something. You know, there's only a handful of them anyway. But in terms of total armed officers, they had dropped by about 1,000, I think it was. So I said, no, they haven't. She said, well, they've said that. I said, they're lying. And she said, well, we'll talk about that then. And I didn't really sort of cotton on to it, but as I always do, if I know I'm going to talk about something, I'll try and do a bit of research first. So I had a bit of a dig around and got the actual figures to hand. And so we started the interview. The other thing that was quite front of mind at the time was the fact that everyone goes on about extra police officers. Extra police officers have been brought in. And I think that was mentioned in the news report that we followed. I said, you know, they're not extra officers. These are officers that have been either dragged in off a rest day, they'll have to have another time, or more likely, they've been dragged in from other duties they should have been doing this afternoon in their local boroughs around London. And I pointed to a few there from Hillingdon, there from whatever, as I'd had a bit of a wander around having a chat with them beforehand. And then she said, oh, well, but we've got more armed officers. We talked about the attack and the incredibly brave response of the police officers that is just breathtaking. And has been recognised now, and that's good. So we had a bit of a chat about those things, and then we came on to that, and I said, no, no. And I remember I answered 3 questions with no, no, no. There's a mate of mine that got a sort of recording of that and put it as his ringtone for when his wife rang him. So that was quite striking, and then we just went through it in detail, and I gave the numbers, and she said, so you're saying the government are lying? I'm, yeah. Michael Fallon's lying, yeah. Now that really took off. It was the Sunday before the 2017 election on the Thursday, and I sort of came home, didn't think anything of it, didn't, you know, I thought I might get a bit of attention, but nothing had ever gone mega viral before. And as I was got myself sorted out and was driving up to Lincolnshire, I'm halfway up to Lincolnshire, and my phone is going berserk. So I pull in for a coffee and start having a look, and a mate of mine says, you've gone viral, mate. Your interview is on a Facebook site that's had 13 million views already. And it had been taken up by the Labour campaign, the Jeremy Corbyn campaign, which was very social media based. Yeah. And so they had taken it and pushed it out there. And now the media were all trying to get me to sort of do other stuff the next day. There must have been, I could have done 20 interviews the next day, but obviously I was busy. Mm. One of them, who was it? Good Morning Britain, I think. They were so keen, they sent up a camera crew to where I was doing the fraud course and interviewed me over breakfast, like up there. They didn't even manage it that day because we ran out of time. So they came back the next day and did it. So we got that point out there, and policing had not been a subject in that election. Well, it had not been a subject in the 2015 election campaign. I'd tried to make it noticed. We'd done an open letter to the government about the cuts, and I'd got people to sign up on Twitter anonymously, because obviously as serving officers you can't do that. But we got this open letter to the government that was published. It was published by the Daily Mirror. It's still out there somewhere. But it still didn't catch. Policing was not an issue. Mm. Then in 2017, the only mention in the Tory manifesto in 2017 was keep beating the police up about stop and search. There was nothing else at all, despite the chaos that was now plain all around them. Labour had tried to bring it in. They realise, I think, that the Tories are very weak on policing. They've destroyed policing. And we had the announcement that they were going to bring 10,000 new officers. And Diane Abbott led that announcement. And she got on the Nick Ferrari show on LBC and just got totally tied up in knots about numbers. And that sort of went viral that she couldn't count, which was unfair to her. And so Labour now weren't going to go near that, because as soon as they mentioned policing, that all came out. So policing had sort of popped up, lasted about 2 hours and dropped again. My interview was an opportunity to bring it back, and they took it with both hands. So it got millions and millions of views, mostly through third party sites. I wish I could have monetized it in some way. A penny for each view would have made a bit of a difference. But the bottom line was, it put policing in the headlines. That the rest of that week, if you watch the Vox Pops, when they were around speaking to people, they were talking about policing. They'd never talked about policing before. The studio stuff on the political shows, they were talking about policing, never been talked about before. It was being recognised that the Tories were very, very weak on policing, and you know, this Labour idea was needed. And so I think it had an effect, bearing in mind it was in the 3 days in the run-up to closing down for the election itself. And I once had on my Twitter profile, once inadvertently brought down a government.
I know you got a lot of support from various outlets. Did you get any criticism for that interview?
One. I can only remember one, apart from the usual trolls that just slag you off anyway.
Now, I know you set up an organisation called the True Blue Line UK with the aim of it becoming an independent think tank influencing policing and policies. Your media profile at the same time lost you a significant amount of paid work. Tell me how you managed to make those ends meet and the effect that it had on you personally.
Yeah, it's difficult, really. I don't know how long I've been doing this, but at least, you know, 12, 13 years on Twitter, I think. I'm not on pension yet. I left early. I left with 21 and a half years service, so I don't get my pension until I'm 60 and then get about half, just over half a pension. So that's not until next October. So I have to work for a living. And having this media profile sort of means that you're not going to get a job in any significant sort in any organisation, because they'll go, oh, well, you can't have that profile. That's not suitable.
I mean, maybe it's naive of me. Why do people think that?
I don't know. They just, organisations don't like scaring the horses. And so, you know, policing and stuff is what I do. So almost everything sort of not really a possibility there. I mean, it's harmed some of my existing business. I've trained the Certificate of Knowledge in Policing since it was invented. And then a local police force took it in-house. They spoke to the college where we'd done the training out of house before, and said, would you do this in 2000 and, I might be a year wrong here, but either 16 or 17. I went in, did two courses there. I thought it went fine. Everybody passed. Everybody seemed fine. It was useful. The students are still in touch with several of them. They, you know, they're getting on fine. Came along the next year, and they suddenly, just before the course started, said, yeah, we want you to do the course to Brooklands, but we don't want Peter Kirkham delivering it. And it took ages to find out why. And the word came back, we don't think that his media profile is appropriate for someone delivering policing training. That meant I lost about 10 grand's worth of work that year. They then came along next year. They did it at the college this time, and again at the last minute they changed their minds and said no, I couldn't do it, even though it wasn't even on their estate anymore. So that's another 5 grand. I don't know whether they've done it this year. Doing what I do for the police service is not only disrupting and taking time that I could be earning to keep a roof over my head, it's actually cost me significant, probably 15, 20 grand over the last 3 years. It coincided with me looking after a friend of mine who was ill with cancer for many years on the other side of London, and that was disruptive as well. You don't recognise that. And if you're self-employed, it just means your earnings drop. People see you on Sky and see you on, you know, all the different media outlets, and they think you must be getting paid a fortune. Well, some don't pay. If you are paid, it's 100 quid, 120 quid. And by the time you've read into it, which I always try and do, got there, done it, got back, that's usually 2, 3, 4 hours out of your day. So you're not going to get rich on it, but it's the disruptive thing, because you can't be doing, you know, you should have been doing something else today and now I'm whizzing off to Sky or whatever. There's a real gap in the market for a specialist policing, crime and public safety issue program there, because the levels of ignorance about policing and everything associated with it, not just in the public, but in the media, in the politicians, even the politicians that have been around it for years, the levels of ignorance are breathtaking. And you don't educate the public unless you tell them stuff. And 2 minutes, 3 minutes on a news programme, even if you repeat it time and time and time again, it doesn't get there. There's a need for a proper policing type, policing politics type show. And I'm the man to present it. So if anyone listening knows or is a Radio 4 commissioning editor, get in touch.
Well, that very nicely brings us on to the final question, I suppose. It's finally, how do you see the future of today's police service? What needs to be done? And what plans do you have for your own future?
I honestly don't think we'll see the police service getting back to where it was in 2010. We've lost numbers, and those numbers can be replaced. We've lost premises and vehicles, and money will bring them back, or new ones. New ones will be better. But what we can't replace is the experience. And it's the experience that is bleeding out of the police service, even as we sit here today, even though we've now got a government that for months has been talking about, you know, 20,000 more police officers in 3 years. Won't happen. You've got no one to recruit them. You've got no one to train them. You've got no one to mentor them. We've got the apprenticeships coming in, which are going to be a nightmare anyway, let alone doubling the volumes going through it. We've got nowhere to put them. It's just not going to happen in 3 years. If you're going to do that, it's going to take 10 years. And during that 10 years, you'll have lost another 40, 60,000 as well. So the volumes are huge. You don't see it in smaller county forces, but when you include all the metropolitan forces, the volumes are huge in terms of recruitment. Even if we replace the numbers, they're not going to be, in inverted commas, street cops, because there's no one there to teach them street coppering. I see it in the Met, and I'm close to the Met still. I'm chair of the Safe and Able board, so I regularly meet with local police. Police officers are out there with 2 or 3 years service working with a new probationer. They're out there with 4 years service being a sergeant looking after a team of basically 3 and 2 and 1 year service officers. So we've lost that experience. Officers bleeding out of the middle of the service and being replaced by bums on seats. The pay and conditions are not good. The fiddling about with the pensions is absolutely appalling, changing the goalposts on people to such a significant extent. That may be resolving itself through the court process now, who knows. But that sort of really, really was the last straw for lots of officers. There is no support from bosses. You get persecuted by the IOPC if something tragic goes wrong. They just simply do not accept that if you've got a lawful right to use force and you've got someone that is using significant force against you, then someone may get seriously hurt or worse, die. That will happen. You cannot see it coming. You cannot stop it happening. It will happen from time to time. So what you need is an investigation, sure, but it needs to be a fair, balanced and proportionate investigation that is done swiftly, just like a murder inquiry. As an SIO, if it took me 3 years to charge someone with murder in a case where the suspect was known from day one, I'd be out of a job. And I, you know, that really, just the delay just illustrates what officers have to face from that side. You're getting attacked more and more on the streets. There's fewer of you. You get no support. abuse in the papers all the time about any use of force is instantly portrayed as police brutality. You have a cup of tea or a coffee, you have to have it out on the street because there's no canteen anymore. Some moron takes a picture of it, sells it to the Sun news desk, it's on the front page, lazy cops, blah, blah, blah. I really do not understand how people are still joining the police service and why those that are in it are staying. They have my utmost admiration, and I'll continue to do everything I possibly can to support them. In terms of my own future, I work as a security services and policing services consultant. I'll do more and more of that, the True Blue Line thing. I've still got this idea to turn it into a proper charity, because I'm more convinced than ever that we need a proper, loud, frontline policing voice. But going a little bit further than the Federation can, because they're serving police officers, so, you know, if they upset the horses too much, they'll find themselves on a charge. But actually sort of taking a bit more of a proactive thing. I mean, I've used the hashtag, if every cop gave a quid. We got 122,000 cops still. If every cop gave a quid, not every day, every week, every month, but just once a year, that's 122 grand. What I would see the True Blue Line being, what I would like it to be, is like a cross between there's the King's Fund for the National Health Service, mm-hmm. that's a recognised external friendly critic, if you like, that keeps an eye on what's happening in the health service. So a cross between that and one of these fact-checking sort of things that challenges the nonsense that's written about policing and puts out the truth, mm-hmm. That does some research, that does... issues some reports, that issues press releases, that holds press conferences, that drives the news agenda, rather than just doing what I can do now as a commentator, which is clatter along in the aftermath, picking up the pieces. Crowdfunding is the answer, unless there's a benevolent millionaire out there. But I mean, like I said, if every cop gave a quid, how many police officers are going to retire this year? A few thousand? 50 quid out of your commutation, 100 quid out of your commutation. It's not going to make a hole at all, and it's a donation to a voice that's going to keep protecting the job that I hope you've enjoyed having and that you've served with pride.
Okay, Peter Kirkham, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.